Begin Podfix Network transmission in 3, 2, 1.
Before we start this episode, I want to give special thanks to Desmond and Shalom, the host of the Not Historians podcast. This interview would not have happened without them. Check out their show. It's great. Thanks again, guys.
I told somebody, I think the other day, that, you know, when Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, he said he invented 1,000 ways not to make the light bulb before he invented the good one. So I hope that I found 1,000 bad suspects and then actually found the right one this time. And here he was. He was everything I'd ever wanted in a Cooper suspect.
Welcome, everyone, to the Gravity Beard Podcast. This is episode 36. We're recording today in Studio C. Thank you, as always, to our listeners. We appreciate your continued support. Today, I'm going to introduce you to Derek Godsey. Derek understands how he's perceived by the world, but I'm going to issue you, the listener, a challenge. As you listen to him present his case, imagine if the same facts were being presented by a subject matter expert. For now, you've never heard of Derek, but if he can get enough attention from the FBI, you'll know exactly who he is. Let's get started. This is the Gravity Beard Podcast. Hey, Derek, welcome to the Gravity Beard Podcast. Thanks for coming on the show.
Man, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad you're here. Before we get into things, I want to give the audience a chance to get to know you a little bit. So where do you currently live?
I live in a little small town with about 2 red lights called Vernon, Alabama.
Is that where you grew up as well?
Yes, sir. Been here almost my whole life.
And how old are you now?
I'm 33 years old.
And are you married? Do you have children?
Yes, sir. I have a wife, 3 kids, a boy and 2 girls.
You're on the show today because you believe you've uncovered the real identity of D.B. Cooper. Is that right?
Yes, sir. I honestly believe so.
We'll get to that a bit later. For those in the audience who have no idea what we're talking about, give a brief summary of who D.B. Cooper is, what he did, and the mystery that surrounds him.
In 1971, there was a lot of hijackings going on, and it was a very crazy year. You know, if you've ever studied history, it was one of the craziest years on record, you know, and a lot of things happened. Vietnam War was going strong. Protests were happening. Just a lot of civil rights was still going on. And this one man captured the whole world's attention in one night, you know, the night before Thanksgiving of all nights. And he got on a plane, well-dressed businessman, smoked, ordered a drink, you know, sat down on the plane as usual, had a briefcase, slipped the woman a note, and asked for $200,000, and he was going to blow the plane up. The woman thought he was kidding at first, and he was hitting on her. But she went on and applied with his rules after she sat down and saw that he was dead serious. You know, they contacted Seattle, and they got the parachutes and the money. The flight took back off, and the man did what he said he was going to do. He parachuted out. You know, the rest is history. Nobody's ever seen him. Nobody had a clue who he was. Just a few composite slips and, you know, a necktie that he left was all that was the only clues we had to go by, you know. And that's why it's been so tough to really track down who this guy was. But I've had my theories on who he was and looked at all the evidence. And I've even had a few favorites myself and always eliminated them for some reason. I would think, well, that couldn't be him. Until the other day, I found this new guy and he stuck with me and he stuck with several others. And I can't find one single thing to rule him out so far, you know? I really believe this is the guy.
Okay, so just a quick summary. A guy hijacked a plane from Seattle to Portland, and in the middle of that flight, he dropped the stairs out of the back of the plane. It was a 727 commercial jet with passengers and crew on it. He'd let the passengers and most of the crew off when they landed the first time. He got $200,000 and 4 parachutes, and then they took off, and then he lowered the stairs. And at 10,000 feet, in the rain and at night, in the dark, and in cold temperatures, because it was the holidays, he jumped out the plane and was never seen from again. And to this day, nobody knows his true identity.
No, sir.
We're not going to go over every detail of the story. You know, listeners can consult Wikipedia, CitizenSleuths.com, or any number of other sources to get caught up. There's lots of podcasts and TV shows and documentaries about it over the years. We're going to focus primarily on your list of suspects, and the one in particular that you think is the real guy.
Yes, sir.
So when was the first time you ever heard of D.B. Cooper?
I was a senior in high school, and it was around that time that Without a Paddle came out, the movie. So me and some friends come and watch it. We was watching it, and they go to this old crazy guy's house, and they were looking for his lost treasure, you know, his lost money. And the guy's name was D.B. Cooper in the movie, and I thought, you know, this is just crazy, make-believe. And one of my friends said, no, man, that was an actual guy. I've heard my grandpa tell stories about him, and that was a real dude that they still hadn't found him. And we were all kidding around that that's what we should go do one day is go find his money, you know? And then that was the last I thought about it till up until a few years ago. And I believe it was Marla Cooper come out, and they thought that her uncle was L.D. was Cooper, and tracked that just a little bit through the newspapers, you know. But last year when I got laid off, I was just reading over some stories, and I come across the Cooper composite sketch again. I thought, good night, that looks just like my grandfather, you know. And there's no telling how many people said that, but, you know, I thought, well, I'm bored, and I just got laid off. So I said, I'm going to start looking at this guy.
How many suspects were on your initial list?
At least three at first, you know, because I'm a big visual guy. The composite sketch, everybody has varying opinions on it, but I think it had to be pretty close, you know what I mean? And so, you know, composite sketch B, they call it, I believe it was the second one. They said it was the closest, so that's the one that I always try to go by.
So go through your list and explain how you eliminated each one of the people on your list.
After I ruled my grandfather out, I come across a few guys that I thought, hey, this was probably him. My first one was Wolfgang Gossett, and I wanted it to be him because he was into, you know, supernatural stuff and had a supernatural talk show late at night, and he would talk about aliens and ghosts and monsters. And this guy just changed his whole life after he got out of the military and became a priest, you know. And I thought, wow, maybe he was trying to make up for something that he'd done earlier in his life, you know, and trying to make it up to God. And he became a priest, and he looked the sketch. I mean, he was identical, you know, pretty much brown eyes and short hair parted. I mean, he had the skills. He was even in the Seattle area at the time. I think it was Fort Lewis up there close to Seattle. So he was in the area, you know. But after I'd read a few things and his sons came out, and he just, there was no evidence, no proof. His fingerprints didn't match up. At the time, they were telling that they had a few DNA strands off the tie and possibly off the back of the seat. And so his sons gave a little bit of his DNA, and it didn't match up. So I kind of, you know, I got bored with him, and I drifted off to my next guy. I became friends with Marla Cooper, and so I told her that I would look into LD, and I did look into him for a couple of weeks, and I never could find anything that hadn't already been found, you know. I was looking into pictures of him and trying to find something that would tie him to the case. And when I first saw that in 2011, I thought, you know, this guy's probably a pretty good suspect. But just his name, you know, alone, I think, ruled him out, because being a Cooper and then using your last name, I don't think anybody in their right mind would have actually did that, you know. So, but Miss Marla was nice, and as a favor, I sort of went along with it and started looking into him, because I felt that he was in the right place, in the right area, and had the right skill set. But just his name, to me, you know, being a Cooper, I really don't think that he would have used his last name at all, you know.
So who was next on your list?
It would have been Rackstraw. And he was my favorite, absolute favorite, till I found my recent guy. I started out, and it was about the time that the History Channel did the documentary D.B. Cooper Case Closed. And so I saw that he had some ties to Alabama, and that's where I live here. So I thought, man, that'd be neat if D.B. Cooper was actually living here at one time, you know. So I started studying him. I was gung-ho, full speed ahead in the Rackstraw. And he had all the skills, the background, the explosive, expert. I mean, his description even fit pretty closely. And the craziness, you know, he was just crazy. That guy, he was a nut, to be honest with you. Actually became well acquainted with Mr. Rackstraw through a fake Facebook profile. He thought I was a woman, so he started carrying on conversations. I left him a phone number one time, and he texted it back. So we started texting, and then he started sending pictures and everything. And it was pictures that I noticed wasn't in the documentary on the History Channel, and also Mr. Colbert's book. So I got in touch with Mr. Colbert and started sending him the pictures and the screenshots of the messages that Rackstraw was sending. So I thought, you know, maybe this way, if this is really Cooper, I'll have my mark on history too, you know.
Back up a couple of steps. You had set up a Facebook profile, but represented yourself as a woman. So explain that briefly. Explain that briefly. And also, tell us who Mr. Colbert is. Who are you talking about there?
I created a fake Facebook profile, and it was a woman. And to be honest, that's what people here do when they want to snoop, because it seems like everybody has a Facebook. So you create a fake one, and you kind of snoop around on people that you don't like, that you wouldn't be friends with, but you still want to keep up with, you know? So I come up with this genius idea that I was going to try to talk to him as a nurse, like a 51-year-old nurse from Amory, Mississippi. And I was going to use a story that my dad was at Fort Rucker when Mr. Rackstraw was at Fort Rucker, and we got to talking. He was asking about my dad and stuff, and he couldn't remember him, but he sort of played like he did remember him a little bit, because my profile picture was a middle-aged, pretty nice-looking woman, you know, so he was flirting. And then I started screenshotting it and giving it to the guy who the History Channel did the documentary with. His name's Thomas J. Colbert. He's wrote a book called The Last Master Outlaw, and it was about Rackstraw, and he had a good bit of evidence, so it was very compelling work, and I thought sure that Rackstraw was probably Cooper. The only difference was he was younger than, you know, the description of Cooper. Rackstraw was only 29 at the time, I believe, 28 or 29.
Thomas Colbert thought that Rackstraw was D.B. Cooper.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
They did a four-hour documentary on Rackstraw.
So after watching the documentary and you getting in personal contact with Rackstraw, you thought you uncovered some things that basically said that the documentary was wrong and that Rackstraw was not the right guy.
Yes, sir. I actually contacted a few of the guys in the documentary via Twitter and other things, and showed them some of the stuff that I'd uncovered. I said, you know, you got the wrong guy here.
So what was the one thing that eliminated Rackstraw in your mind?
He had blue eyes, and a lot of people say Cooper had dark brown eyes, and I know that he wore the sunglasses most of the time, but that was a catch. And in his age, you know, he was up to 28, and they said Cooper was, the first report that I read, he was 50 is what the first description said, and then later on it was middle 40s was the main belief that that's the age of Cooper. So I was thinking, there's no way you can get 28 and 45 mixed up, you know, not that big of a difference. After talking to Rackstraw that long, posing as a woman, and some of the stuff that he would send and the way that he talked to the person that he believed I was thinking, you know, as pretty as Tina was and even Florence Schaffner, there's no way that he wouldn't have hit on either one of those women, if not both of them. So, I mean, I know that sounds really strange and silly, but if you would see him as a woman, there's no way he wouldn't have not said something out of the way to either one of those women.
And I think when we talk about who you really think D.B. Cooper was, I think we'll elaborate a little bit on that later. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Were there anybody else on your list of suspects that you eliminated?
There was a guy, his name was Don Burnsworth, and he fit the Cooper composite sketch to a T, and he was a United Airlines pilot, and he had several patents for the actual 727 itself, too. And so I looked at him extensively, and he was interviewed and even arrested for related crimes, but they never could charge him with hijacking. But they did everything. They took his DNA and his fingerprints and everything. And finally, the FBI had to release him, and they let him go and ruled him out as a suspect. So I kind of moved on for him. But in the back of my mind, you know how you want somebody to be something so bad that you sort of, you know, you get stuck on him and you quit paying other people any of attention, you know. And that's sort of why I wanted Rackstraw to be him, because of my interactions with him. And I could always show everybody, hey, I've actually talked to D.B. Cooper.
This case has been around for over 45 years. In that time, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies did an exhaustive investigation. In fact, it was an open case still until just last year, when the FBI gave up and declared it a cold case. In addition, countless individuals like yourself have done their own investigations over the years. After all that, you come along, seemingly a random guy from a small town in Alabama, and you're claiming that you found someone that everyone else has overlooked.
Yes, sir.
So in preparation for this interview, you and I had a phone call a couple of days ago, mainly because I wanted to determine if you were a nutcase or not. Right?
That's understandable. Yes, sir.
Because anytime somebody comes out of the woodwork and makes an extraordinary claim like what you made, I don't want to just put them on my show and have them turn out to be, you know, a lunatic, and then it's just a complete waste of everyone's time. I don't think you're a nutcase or a lunatic. All that brings us to this very point. What is the name of the person who you believe is the real D.B. Cooper?
The person that I really believe was D.B. Cooper, otherwise known as Dan Cooper, was a man named James E. Klasnick. He was a Boeing engineer for 37 years and also a manager for the hydraulic department. He lived in Bellevue, Washington almost his whole life. He had every bit of the things that Tom Kay mentions on his citizensleuths.com website. I went by it as a checklist. I found everything. I lined them up. But the picture find was just, honestly, it was a gift from God, because I've searched the same thing 100,000 times in that picture. I've never seen it before in my life. And just one day, March 25th, it was there. And I was like, this is a miracle, you know?
Pause right there for just a second, because that's our first critical question in this conversation. How did you discover him? And why are you convinced that he's the real guy? Because he's never come up anywhere. He's not on Wikipedia. He's not been mentioned in documentaries. He's not on Citizen Sleuths. He doesn't show up on the forums. Like, this man's name has never come up in connection with this case, and you're convinced he's the guy. Like, you've spent time, and as you try to test it and determine that he's not the guy, he's passing the test. So how did you discover him, and why are you so convinced he's the real guy?
I know this sounds really strange, and I don't know how anybody in the audience believes, but one day I said, Lord, I don't know if anybody's ever prayed to actually find D.B. Cooper. I know people are out on the ground blind and using all kinds of means, but I don't know if anybody actually got down and prayed and asked God, please help them find D.B. Cooper. But I said, Lord, I asked for your help. And that's been probably 2 months ago. And so that day, it was March 25th, I was searching through there, and I was just typing in Boeing engineers, 1965, 1966. And I was seeing this picture of this man wearing a black clip on top, standing underneath a airplane, kneeled down, and he's got all his complexion, skin, his hair is combed to the same side, it's dark hair, dark eyes, and I thought, who in the world is this? Is this a joke or something, you know? And I clicked on it, and it was an article about the 727, Boeing 727, and I thought, my goodness. So I got interested, started reading it, and the more I read, it was the hydraulics of the aft stairs, they use hydraulics, and then the rotors are controlled through hydraulics. And then it talked about the flaps and stuff on there. And I thought, my goodness. And at the end of it, it said James E. Klasnick, hydraulic engineer for the Boeing company. And I thought, man, this is weird, really, really weird. And so I started typing in this guy's name in Google, and I actually copied it and pasted it, you know. And the very first thing come up was his obituary. If you've never read anybody's obituary in your whole life, you have to read this guy's. It's the most entertaining, informative obituary I've ever. I don't believe Elvis Presley's obituary was this great, like, for real. I got more information out of his than I did studying Brack Straw for 6 months, you know. And I saw that he died in 2014, and I thought, man, he's dead anyway. But I clicked on it, so that would make him 51 years old at the time of the hijacking. And I know that sounds a little old, but very first description on the FBI files is they called in, and he said he was 50 years old, 6'1", 175 pounds, 50 years old. And I thought, well, man, that goes along with it, you know? And so his very first lines in his obituary is, let's raise a martini on the rocks, one olive, to the life of Jim Klasnick. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know that? This guy was a drinker, you know, so, but I got interested in that, and I started reading down through there, and I just absolutely fell in love with the guy, You know, he was everything I'd ever wanted. You know, I know that's a cliche saying, but if you're looking for somebody like for love or a wife, you know, you got your, you know, your things that you would like to have in a woman. And I had my stuff that I wanted in a Cooper suspect, and here he was, perfect. I mean, everything I'd ever wanted.
Tell us a little bit more about his background and history and why that makes him a perfect fit for being the right guy.
He was born on a farm. I don't even know how to pronounce this. I'm sorry. It's Enumclaw or something like that. It's in the Seattle area. But he grew up on a farm milking cows, actually milking cows. Went to school. He worked his way and paid for his own college at Seattle. Became an engineer. He was doing electricity work and things like that as a youth to make money to go to college and pay his own way. And wound up when World War II happened, he joined the Army and was flying the B-17 bomber and was shot down over Austria in 1944. And he parachuted out, and him and his crew, and they ran to this old abandoned cabin and survived in there for a few days. And the Germans found them and surrounded them, and they said, "Get out," in German. And his mother spoke German, apparently, so he knew what that meant. So him and his friends were captured, and he was held in Germany, Barth, Germany, for 13 months as a prisoner of war. You can only imagine what that would be like to, you know, be held that long by the Nazis. And then in 1945, he was released and came back to America and got married. And he got his job at Boeing Company and was working there, made several patents for the Boeing 727 airplane. But one of the things that stuck out to me was when he was shot down, you know, 1944. You know, I couldn't imagine what that was like. I know a lot of people talking about diving into the night and the cold, you know, but it's controlled. You're controlling it. You're not controlling the elements, but you're not worried about who's on the ground shooting at you. And, you know, because they didn't know at the time where Cooper jumped. But when he was shot down in World War II, I'm sure there was people shooting at him, you know, shooting at the parachute. Troops were out there on the ground looking for the crew. So this wasn't his first rodeo, you know, the hijacking. So,
you know, you may not have all the answers, and I don't think you have to. I don't think you have to have all the answers to have identified the right guy necessarily. But just to summarize your opinion about what happened, your opinion is that the whole thing was a solo effort. He survived the jump, landed, and got away with the money. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So let's spend just a couple of minutes putting your theory to the test and discussing some of the challenges that he would have faced in what he was trying to pull off. First off, he's not a young guy. You know, you're saying he was around 50 years old, and the FBI profile confirms that. It's cold, it's dark, it's raining. He's presumably dressed in a suit and a trench coat, not good skydiving clothes in any conditions. He's jumping into harsh terrain, either water or heavy woods. The odds of surviving that are staggering, if not impossible.
Yes, sir.
How does he survive a jump like that? And then once he's successful in landing, how does he get rid of the parachute? How does he know where he is when he lands? And how does he get where he's going? And what does he do with the money? Because other than $5,800 that's found on the Tina bar, none of the other bills show up in circulation. Let's just start with the conditions and what the chances are of surviving a jump like that. And in your opinion, why he was able to survive such a thing.
Yes, sir. I went through some of the conditions in Germany in 1944, and they were very similar. It's still really cold over there. He was shot down in April in Germany, and it was still really, really cold and windy. So the conditions, you know, from ground to the airplane, it's not like you're going to be in the sky. I think it's like 8 minutes, something like that. So I know it was cold and everything, but he'd been through worse. And to be honest with you, a suit and a trench coat in 1971 was probably like having a polarized jumpsuit on compared to the clothes that they had in 1944, the military suit and all, you know. And so I wasn't ever really too bad worried about that. But his age, it did kind of throw me off at first when he was 51. I thought, this is a little old to be jumping out. But if you read his obituary, it talks about him working out at the Bellevue Club. So he was still working out. You know, this guy was amazing shape. When I read on that the guy was 94 when he died, and still up until he was 92, he was skiing, you know. And if you've ever been snow skiing, I told my wife the other day, that's one of my favorite hobbies, and we go to North Carolina a lot and go skiing in Virginia. I said, that is the roughest sport to me that I feel like I'd play in a football game after I get done. And for him to still be doing that at 92 years old tells you a lot about his health when he was 51, you know. And so I kind of checked that off. I thought I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Parachutes are easy to dispose of. You can either burn them or you can, bury them. But I honestly believe he probably buried it. I still haven't ruled out that it wasn't an Amboy chute, you know, that they found in Amboy, Washington. But, I would need more proof of that and everything. But
just talk about the landing conditions, because a lot of people theorize he didn't survive. He either landed in water and froze and drowned to death, or he could have hit anywhere in a forest and could have been impaled and just killed upon impact with a tree.
Yes, sir. That's very true and very possible. But, I honestly believe that if it would have happened, I believe we would have found the money and the parachute, and somebody would have slipped up and talked. You know how people can't keep a secret, especially back then. Somebody would have messed up and talked and said exactly what happened, and we would have this would all be ancient history. But I honestly believe he made it. There were several landing strips around there, closed landing strips, World War II landing strips, that's privatized, that people was on. There's a Mr. Sutton's airstrip right over there beside Lake Merwin. And you never hear many people talk about it, but I was looking at it the other day, and it's been around since the 30s, and I thought, man, that would have been a perfect place to parachute out if you was looking at Lake Merwin, and you flew out over there, and you would know exactly where Mr. Sutton's landing strip was at.
So you still believe that there were enough spots that it wasn't pure luck, that he could have landed safely?
Yes, sir. I honestly believe that.
Okay. So let's move on to the money, because he took $200,000. That was 10,000 bills. I think it weighed somewhere between 20 and 25 pounds. They were all documented before they gave it to him. The only money that was found about 9 years later that washed up near the Tina Bar. And it was only $5,800 out of the 200,000. So do you have a theory on what happened to the money? Because it's never turned up in circulation.
No, sir. I honestly believe that he buried it right then, because you could tell, when they found the money, they knew that it had been buried for some time. And that's another thing about the money find. It was three bills. The rubber bands wasn't even broke on them, and they were stacked right up on top of each other, and that was really fishy. If it washed in the shore, it'd be spread out. We would have found more of it. I honestly believe the money was planted. The rubber bands would have been missing. They were still all intact. But I believe he buried the money, and once he found out that they had pre-recorded it, I honestly believe that he never spent a dime of it. And I believe that the money plant was sort of a symbolism for Tina Bar, and Tina Mucklow. She's the one that brought him the money. That's just a big coincidence, because there's so many sandbars along through there in Portland. He could have used Caterpillar Island or any of those through there. And he chose Tina Bar, for Tina Mucklow. And that's too big of a coincidence, to overlook, to me, in my opinion.
The hijacking took place the day before Thanksgiving, and you actually have one more extraordinary detail as part of your theory. You believe that after surviving the jump and evading capture, that he returned to work on Monday.
Yes, sir. I believe it. I believe he was back in there in his engineering department as a manager, and I honestly believe that that's why he was never questioned, never thought of as a suspect at all, because you've seen the picture and you've seen his background, and you know that somebody else had to know all that about Mr. Klansnik. And for him not to ever be in the FBI spotlight, it's because he went back to such an ordinary style. And he had kids in college at the time, and some of them was living in the Portland area. His daughters even worked in Amboy, and one of them worked in Battleground, Washington. So he sort of knew that area, And I'm not saying that they were complicit in any of the hijacking or anything like that, but I believe he'd been through there enough that he knew exactly what was what. You can read in that article, he knows the 727 better than the guy who built it, that created it, in my opinion. He goes into such great detail, and that's what caught my eye. But that's my theory, is that he went back and was so ordinary again on that Monday that nobody paid him any of attention, And by looking at him and having such a great life and great kids, they thought, well, this guy didn't need the money.
So given that there were multiple people that had close extended interaction with him, and that there was a composite sketch that to this day is one of the most famous of all time, how did he return to work on Monday and not be easily identified?
I think that he returned back to his normal pace. He went back in to work Monday morning. You know, he wasn't hurt, wasn't scratched up. He's the boss, you know, so people, it's not like you're a coworker and they're just going to say, where was you at Wednesday? I mean, he's the actual boss, you know, so, and I wish there was a way that we could check his work record and see that Wednesday before Thanksgiving, you know, if he was actually at work or not, and maybe there is a way. He went back to life as normal, and that's why nobody ever questioned, because him being in that position, you wouldn't think that he needed the money, and that goes, his composite sketch, oh my goodness, it's frightening how much he looks just like Cooper. And it even looks like he's got the same Cooper, the same necktie on that, you know, is in custody right now. I mean, it's a black clip-on tie. You can't zoom in enough to tell what kind it is, but it looks just like it. And the fact that he's at work underneath an airplane and he's got a pack of cigarettes in his pocket, and I can't tell which kind they are either, but it shows you he was a smoker, a drinker. He had time at work. And
So question, that's the thing, is that the composite sketch, how do you explain the fact that the composite sketch was all over the place and nobody said, hey, my boss or my coworker or this guy that I know looks exactly like this composite sketch? How do you explain that part? I mean, he was hiding in plain sight, basically.
Yep. And they say that's the best place to hide, you know, but I throw that back on the FBI director right then, Ralph Himmelsbach, or the man in charge of Norjak. He said he was a dirty, rotten criminal, probably been in crime his whole life, probably been in and out of jail. And as far as I know, I haven't found one thing where Mr. Klasnick was ever arrested and, you know, never in any kind of trouble. And I think that they were looking for the wrong type of man. He didn't fit the profile that Mr. Himmelsbach and them were looking for. You know, even though he looks just like him, you know, they were, you know how we've been profiling now, racial profiling and social profiling. It was sort of like that back then. They were in the wrong profile looking instead of keeping an open mind.
So what you're saying is that was bad police work and the FBI just had a bad profile.
Yes, sir.
And one thing he did have wrong was in the stories about the hijacking, one of the things that is notable about the demeanor of whoever it was is that he was very calm and polite.
Sure was. He even offered to buy him supper, you know?
Right.
He offered to have everybody, and he offered to tip the waitresses for the drinks. I mean, if you're fixing to extort $200,000 from somebody and you're mad, you know, that's the last thing on earth you're going to do is, you know, offer a tip. Or even when Tina was joking about, can I have some of the money, he pulled out a couple of bundles, you know, and was fixing to give her some of it. And that's another thing that sort of always stuck out to me on the plane. She's jokingly saying, can I have some of it? And he offers her a few bundles. And in 1980, when a few bundles was found, where was it found at? Tina Bar. And Tina's the one that asked him for it, you know. So that's my symbolism. I always thought that that's why, you know, he left that there just as a gesture, you know.
You've actually had interaction with members of James E. Klasnick's family.
Yes, sir.
Talk about that a little bit.
The first person I called, I looked it up on Yellow Pages. It was a James E. Klasnick Jr. And so I called it, and it wound up being this young man named Tyler. He was very nice and everything. He said, I think he has the wrong number, but he didn't tell me that I actually had the right number. He just told me that he thought I was looking for somebody else because I asked for his grandfather right off the bat. And so when I hung up, I called the same number again, and this time I got voicemail, and it was Tyler Klasnick. He said, leave a message or text him. And so I text him. I said, hey, Tyler, I'd like to talk to you about your grandfather, James E. Klasnick. And that was all I said. And then he wrote back and he said, yes, this is, I asked, are you kin to him, Mr. Klasnick? He wrote, yes, this is, yes, I am. What's up? That's the exact words. And so I wrote back and I said, I'd like to talk to you about your grandfather. I think, I said, don't laugh, but I think he may be D.B. Cooper. And he never wrote back. And I called and I called and I called. So I looked up more numbers in there under the Klasnicks, and I would match them to the obituary to make sure that they were his actual kids. there were several, Mike, one of his sons is James E. Klasnick Jr., and that's the one they call Jimmy Jet. And he's the one that I called his workplace and actually talked to his boss. And his boss emailed me back and said that they can't give out any information or anything, but he would give him my contact information, and I still hadn't heard anything back. But so, you know, if you contact somebody's boss, you know they're going to give you the message. So I know they're avoiding me. And then the next day, Tyler writes back and writes, "Who is this?" Again, I told him my name's Derek Godsey from Vernon, Alabama, and I give him my email address, told him I'd like to talk to him about his grandfather. And I said, "You know, I think he's D.B. Cooper." I said, "That's not a bad thing. I mean, it could possibly be worth a lot of money and a lot of media attention and fame to your family, you know, and even you, because I think Tyler's around my age." But they never did respond again, you know. And I told somebody the other day, it may have been you, I said, if these people just answer my phone call and cuss me out and tell me I better leave their family alone or go file a police report and say that I was harassing them, you know, and I'm not harassing them, but if they told the police that I needed to leave them alone, I would certainly go by the law, you know, and leave them alone. But it's like they're avoiding me. And what I think happened was Tyler talked to his parents after I got in contact with him, and they told him to stay out of it. So hopefully, I think that they know something, you know, or something come back to their memory, or, he may have really been Cooper, you know. That's when I started contacting the FBI.
Okay, so we'll get to the FBI in just a minute. But here's where I want to circle back on something that we talked about earlier, and that was related to Rackshaw. He took the bait of your female Facebook profile and how he interacted with you there. Explain how that eliminated Rackshaw, but put the focus on Klasnick and how that's related to Klasnick.
Yes, sir. So when I was talking to Mr. Rackshaw, I mean, he was pretty sexual. He was sending all kind of texts, you know, and so he started sending me nude pictures. I mean, talking just ridiculous, man. And so that sort of right then, after I talked to him a few days, it sort of eliminated him, because I was thinking this guy was sure enough, like, at least hit on, you know, Tina, or said something rude. But Mr. Klasnick, once I got to studying him and everything, and I started studying his children and looking into them and all, and I don't know what it was about Mr. Klasnick, and he was a great guy. He was very generous. But I always sort of got this feeling that Mr. Klasnick may have been gay, and I can't explain it, and I don't know if it's a hunch, and I may be 100 miles way off in left field, because he was married, had all these kids, but just something about him, it always jumped out to me that, you know, he may have been gay. And so I got to studying further, and that's when I found his son Tom was a principal in Portland, and he was the one in 2013 who was wrongfully, you know, fired because he came out as gay, and the school board got together and fired Tom Klasnick because he come out as gay. And then later on, he was able to sue him, and rightfully so. You know, I ain't got anything against anybody that's gay. I got family members that's gay. But that stood out to me that if he really was gay, that's the reason he didn't, you know, flirt more with Tina or say anything out of the way. Because, I mean, she's a 20-year-old beautiful flight attendant, and she spent several hours with him, and some of it alone, and he never said one thing out of the way to her, you know. I don't know many men, married or not, that wouldn't have, you know, because she was beautiful. And especially when she's giving you all the money and she's scared and she's paying you all kind of attention. And he was a perfect gentleman the whole time, you know. So that sort of come back to me, my believing again, that was Klasnick on there, because he was such a giving gentleman. And, you know, I have no way to back that up, that he was gay. It's just a hunch. And then his son was gay, you know, so. I just thought that maybe that was a lead right there in itself.
Your year-long journey up to this point has been to find the right guy. You've done that now. What's next? What are you trying to accomplish at this point?
Yes, sir. Just to try to get enough questions asked, like, what about this Klasnick guy? Have y'all looked into him? And try to get the FBI's attention and to get the story heard out there, and maybe somebody can put two and two together. And maybe somebody knew Mr. Klasnick. And I think I shared this with you briefly, but the March 25th was when I found Mr. Klasnick's picture on there, and I fell in love with the guy. And I thought, this is D.B. Cooper, and I have solved the crime of the century. My kids are always going to have something to remember me by. And my wife had this dog named Cooper, and we named it Cooper. And I promise you that I could not make this up. That dog come up and vanished that very day, March 25th. I'll never forget it. And I have not seen that dog since. And so after me and you talked the other day, my wife said, did you tell him that you can't even find Cooper the dog, much less B.B. Cooper? Because I have rode the roads. I have looked for that dog everywhere. And Vernon is like 2,000 people, and everybody knows everybody's business. And nobody has seen that dog. I mean, it's like Ariel Washington where Cooper jumped out at. I mean, he has vanished, man. And
Did any money around your house come up missing?
No, but there was some lasagna on the table that was gone, so I know that he left on a full stomach. And lasagna is my favorite food. And she said, well, at least he was full when he vanished. But, I mean, it's just so nobody has seen anything. And it was like a sign from the heavens. I'm like, oh, my goodness. And so I told my wife, I said, baby, once we get all this settled and everything, I will find Cooper the dog. So I'm going to put a ACB out on him and try to.
Well, I'm sorry you lost your dog in all this. That's terrible.
It is terrible, but it's sort of like, you know, how I talked about the Tina Bar and the Tina Mucklow situation. It's sort of like that. It's like the love of my life. I found one love and lost another in the same exact day. I'm hoping that's a great sign. You know?
It's all coming together. Just a clarification. When you say you discovered it on March 25th, you're talking about 3 weeks ago.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You can ask my wife. I have not hardly slept at all. And that's all I do is try to get in touch with members of his family. I have searched this guy. It's like I've received like a relief. You know, it's like I'm not even looking for Cooper anymore, the person. You know, it's like I know who he was. I just got to prove who he was, you know, to without a reasonable doubt.
I understand you've shared your findings with the community of people who have been following the D.B. Cooper case. Have you been received in that community?
A lot of them won't even write me back, and I'd made good friends with some of them, you know, and like we shared jokes and laughs, and it's like they disowned me. It's like, how did you come up with this guy? And nobody writes me back. And then I've made several friends, like Mr. Tom K, the Citizen Sleuth website. He's the guy that analyzes stuff on the time. He would joke around about Nice Try and stuff like that. And now he won't even respond to anything that I send him about Mr. Klansnik. And it's like, I hope it's jealousy. You know, I hope I'm taking it as a good sign. I don't hold it against any of them, but I'm hoping that they're all busy looking into Mr. Klansnik now. But the other day, me and a guy named Bruce Smith was sort of back and forth on one of his websites talking about Cooper, and he said that I owed the Klansnik family an apology. And I said, you know, I've tried to contact these guys nonstop. And I said, all they got to do is call me and tell me to stop, or I've got the wrong guy, or show me something. You know, don't leave me hanging out here. I said, until they do that, I'm not going to apologize, and I'm going to keep hammering.
You had signed up and were participating in a D.B. Cooper forum, and you got kicked out of the forum.
Yes, sir.
How did you get sideways with the D.B. Cooper forum?
There was a few of the people, like when I would make a post or my opinion about something, they would just make fun of it. And so one guy, he's actually a Cooper suspect. It's his daughter. She's on there. And I was being real mean, you know, but I was half playing. But I wrote her and said, maybe the reason your daddy up and vanished was because of you. You know, and looking back, that was so dumb. And I shouldn't have said anything like that. And, you know, and after these people had already dogged me out. And so it was just snide remarks. And
okay, so you got on there and you were acting kind of ornery.
Yes, sir. Fair enough.
I just think it's so strange that you're not getting more widely embraced by people that have spent time on this. I think it's really weird.
Me being who I am too, I understand that part, but they reply to me when it's somebody else that I was wrong about, and like they would say, ha ha, I knew better than that. And you know, it didn't go nothing along with whatever they were looking for, and now I got somebody that they were looking for I think I sent it to you, but I printed it off the Citizen Sleuth page. It said, so in conclusion, Cooper was probably a manager or an engineer and wore a clip-on tie to work. And so I found him, that guy, and now he won't even respond to me, you know. And so, but that's all right. That's his loss, you know.
But one of the things that you told me is that they weren't that accepting of you because they all had their own guy. So,
yes,
so my related question to that is, big deal. So they've all got their guy and they feel strongly about their guy. You've got your guy. Why would they give you a hard time about that? Just because, is it because you had mentioned this before? Is it because they were jealous that you came up with somebody that no one's ever come up with before?
Yes, sir. In my own opinion, and you know, I may not know anything about this, but I have been studying hard, and I told a couple of them, I said, we'll never find D.B. Cooper because everybody is so set in their ways and they all have their favorite suspect, and it don't matter if the FBI rules them out or their hair don't match or their eye color don't match or they were in Egypt at the time of the hijacking. They still think that's the guy, and that kind of thinking isn't going to solve the case. We had to have somebody that was going to be thinking open-minded, and like I told you, I changed suspects 3 or 4 different times before I found my different guy, you know, because I was trying to keep an open mind and look at it from way off. Not, you know, I've never been involved in the case or anything. So I think it was going to take that kind of thinking to, you know, not look through the rose colored glasses and to sort of match everything with everything. Like I used opinions from Mr. K. I used opinions from Mr. Smith, the one that was dogging me out the other day. And I say dogging me out. He's actually been pretty nice to me. But I used all of their opinions, even the guys that I was, you know, making the snide remarks to and getting kicked off the forum for. I took a little bit of everything that they had, and to me, I found the perfect Cooper suspect, you know. And
okay,
you really got to keep an open mind. I told some of the guys on the forum that are older, I didn't tell them directly, but it's like they're so set in their ways that it's going to take a younger generation to get interested in it, that understand social media. Not saying that I do, because man, I don't even have nothing but an iPhone, but just a new way of thinking may can actually solve this thing. And I hope that's what has happened with us, you know, and like you helping me out, getting the word out. And
so I understand you've reached out to the FBI with all of your findings. How did that go?
I was really nervous. And I mean, even the woman that took my call made me feel like I was D.B. Cooper. I mean, we didn't talk, but I think it was 4.5 minutes. And, I mean, she had me sweating. Those guys are really, really good. Or in gal, she was a woman. But and she was real nice. And she said, oh, my goodness, how in the world did we miss this guy? That was her exact word.
Has anybody ever, in the entire history of this case, as far as you're aware, or even recently, has anybody pointed towards Klasnick as the potential suspect?
No, sir, as far as I know. And the woman, when she was taking my report, she pulled it up in the file, I guess, or whatever, just to search his name, and there was nothing. Because there's like 1,200 people that they investigated, you know?
They investigated 1,200 people?
Yes, sir, around 1,200 people. And I told her his background and how I found him, and she said, well, we'll pass it along. She said, as you know, the Cooper case is closed, but we're still taking leads that go along with the parachute and the money fine. And so I said, thank you so much. And she was very nice, and I didn't hear nothing back for the next few days, so I got a little impatient. And I started writing letters, and so I wrote one to the Portland office, and then I wrote one to the Seattle office again. And I went and made me some pictures of the picture that I sent you, the one where he's under the plane. And I thought, you know, if you read a letter, you just look over it. But if it's actually got a picture right there with it that you can see, it sort of bears more weight than an actual letter. You know, you see something that you're somebody's writing about. And so I made a bunch of those pictures that I've been mailing out. I mailed them to the Attorney General's office, the FBI office in Washington. And, you know, I just thought it's a long shot, and I ain't got nothing else to do. So I thought, why not? I ain't got nothing to lose, and I ain't doing nothing illegal. So might as well keep on keeping on. A few days later, the lady at the FBI office, Miss Ann Beecher Williams, finally emailed me back, and she said, this is interesting. She said, Derek, as you know, we're no longer investigating the case. She said, but I will pass this to the former and lead investigator in the Norjack case. So I knew she knew what she was talking about. And I'd actually seen her on TV before in the History Channel documentary. So I knew she was legit, you know. She's a spokeswoman for the Seattle FBI. I've sent them 1,000 people, you know, and they have never emailed me back, never answered my phone calls or anything. And this time, they actually emailed me back, and I was astonished, you know. So I'm taking that all as good news.
Do you think you would have had better luck if you had done this a year ago before the FBI officially closed the case?
Absolutely. Man, I sure would have. But, man, I'm telling you, I was so green that I didn't have a clue. Like I said, I just went by appearances.
So procedurally, do you know what the difference is before and after the FBI closes the case in terms of how they handle new leads or stuff that comes in?
No, sir. Just one guy told me that it has to be a whopper for them to even consider it. And he told me that Mrs. Williams actually corresponding with me and emailing me back. That meant that it took, you know, interest. She took interest in it because the picture itself is undeniable, you know. And what I think really helped my case was the Expedition Unknown, where Mr. K and them get on there and they take the tie to Chicago somewhere and get it analyzed. And that's when they start finding the titanium and everything. And then that's when he says that it was a high probability he was a manager or engineer.
Sounds like when you contacted the FBI that they took you pretty seriously. How did that make you feel?
It made me feel really good because I've contacted them several times. I've not heard anything from anybody, you know, and to get that, I was honored, and it sort of lit a fire under me because I thought, well, man, actually somebody's paying attention. And then, you know, I got in contact with you too, and it's really made me feel a lot better that people actually listen because, you know, I honestly 100% believe this is him. And if it's not, I will do everything I can to apologize to his family and everything, if, you know, if they'll contact me. But them avoiding me makes me sort of feel like maybe they do know something, or maybe they're holding a story and going to try to make money for it themselves or something, you know, which is understandable.
Well, Derek, I think it's fascinating. I'd like to officially go on record and say that I believe you. I think you have identified the real D.B. Cooper, and I believe he is indeed the deceased James E. Klasnick. I appreciate you choosing to use this show to share your findings and announce your discovery.
Man, I really, you know how much that means to me because I've been so laughed at. I told somebody, I think the other day, that, you know, when Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, he said he invented 1,000 ways not to make the light bulb before he invented it, the first, you know, the good one. So I hope that I found 1,000 bad suspects and then actually found the right one this time, I hope.
This is an ongoing effort for you. You know, landing on the right suspect is not the end for you. It could be just the beginning.
Yes, sir. And that's what I'm trying to get ideas, and using your show is going to be a big step. I mean, it's because I know you got a lot of followers and everything, and man, I'm definitely going to owe you one for life for just letting me come on here, just a poor country boy from Alabama. You know, I'm going to try to use social media and websites and podcasts, and, you know, I'd even thought about getting in touch with the local news and try to see, you know, because I'm sort of embarrassed too because I'm afraid they'll laugh at me, but I ain't got no pride anymore or anything. Like, I don't even have a job, so I got to try something, you know. But the one hope I do have is Senator Sessions was always my senator, and he came to us our senior year and talked to our whole class, and we got to shake hands with him and spend a few minutes. And so I wrote him some letters and talked to my senator now, Senator Shelby, and trying to get them aware of it. And him being over the Justice Department, you know, now, you know, being Attorney General, I hope that can give me some kind of weight and at least get an ear for them to listen to us, you know.
Well, as things develop further, I'd like to extend you an open offer for you to come back on the show anytime you like to give us updates. I am more than happy to help you spread the word.
Man, I really appreciate that. And you'll always be my first choice and my favorite because you were my first, you know. And you were the, I won't never forget it. If this blows up, we're all over the world, I'll still tell them about your show. And you was the first one to believe in us. And man, it means a lot to me.
You're in with me now. I stay loyal. You're going. This is our Cooper suspect now. So,
all right. I appreciate it.
Because, I mean, you don't understand how many people have ignored me. So,
well, you're welcome.
I hope that we solve this. And I notice I say we because it's all of us. You're in with it. with me now, so we're all a part of it. We're all Cooper, like they say. We're all Negan on The Walking Dead. We're all Cooper now.
Best of luck to you. Please stay in touch.
All right, man. See you later.
See you, Derek. Thanks so much. Bye. The world is full of skeptics. Historically, I've been one of the biggest. But if you could put that aside, why couldn't a guy from Vernon, Alabama, solve one of the biggest crimes in U.S. history? Once again, I'd like to give special thanks to the guys at the Not Historians podcast. Nothing unusual to report on the intern front, except that I found Lou on the top of a human pyramid in our lobby when I came into work today. I'm sure it means nothing. I'd like to recommend to you the Varmints podcast. It's hosted by Paul Shomo and Donna Hume. Every week they do a whole bunch of research to educate themselves and you, the listener, on all things that creep, crawl, slither, fly, jump, hop, and swim on the planet, one animal at a time. They aren't animal experts, but they are incredibly entertaining, so please give them a listen. Oh, and be kind to animals. You can listen to the Gravity Beard podcast on iTunes, Podbean, or anywhere else you consume podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at TheGravityBeard, and of course, we're on Facebook. You can also email us at contactthebeard@gmail.com. We definitely want to hear from you. And please stop by iTunes to subscribe to the show. Our theme song is Sophomore Makeout by Silent Partner. In the intro, we use the song I Still Want You by Everett Almond. You can find both of these songs by searching for them by name on the YouTube audio library. And now we're treating you to Quitting Time by Patrick Lee, CC by NCSA 3.0. You can search for him by name at freemusicarchive.org. Here's what's coming up on the show. I have some negotiating to do, but Liam may be back next week. Could also be another installment of Bad Date Stories. Of course, could be some third thing I'm not aware of at the moment. You just have to stick your hand in the mystery bag and see what you pull out. After that, we'll finally have our appearance by our millennial correspondent, Ben Hines. Our sincere apologies for bumping him this week. We needed to put a rush on our D.B. Cooper interview. And of course, there's plenty of other audio eclairs headed your way. This is the Gravity Beard Podcast. It's what your ears will want to be listening to.
This is the Gravity Beard Crabcast.
She said, oh my goodness, how in the world did we miss this guy? That was her exact word. Yes, sir. I believe it.
I mean, he was hiding in plain sight, basically.
And they say that's the best place to hide. I think that they know something. I'm not even looking for Cooper anymore. I know who he was. I just got to prove who he was. So might as well keep on keeping on.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Podfix Network. Discover more audible gems like this at podfixnetwork.com. Make sure to catch up-to-the-minute network shenanigans by following @Podfix on Twitter. @Official_Podfix on Instagram, @Podfix Network on Facebook, and make sure to subscribe to Podfix Presents wherever you choose to find podcasts. The Podfix Network, artist owned and loved.